Thank you, colleagues. My name is Tony McKay, and thank you for the opportunity of being part of, John, a remarkable couple of days. This afternoon I'm going to take on the affiliation of the OECD, Sarah, and in particular Dirk and David, draw on the fact that I was part of the Schooling for Tomorrow project that lasted in all, David, 10 years. So I was quite a young man when I joined that particular enterprise, and but it has helped us all to think about the promise of a future. And that's going to be the focus of this afternoon's session. But just before we launch into what will be a remarkable five-person panel contribution, so this is really something to look forward to, five presentations, and then an opportunity for people to, I hope, in a very short space of time, so that we can leave here on time, to invent the future. If we can just nail that this afternoon, a future for the profession. And can we be clear, we're talking about a future. We don't need plural. Okay, so can we just avoid any complexity about futures? That would be really helpful. Because we do need to, I was going to say pull stumps. That's an appropriate thing to say in England, but not in Scotland. No, I realise that. But I actually realise at the moment I'm not in Scotland, John. So, but 5 o'clock is the moment where this gathering will conclude, formally at least. And if that hadn't become immediately apparent to you on the basis of your documentation, because it didn't appear, then can we just be clear now that it's 5 o'clock that we will finish? That'll help people with their travel arrangements and other things. But the doors are locked now, so those who wanted to leave early, it'll be quite embarrassing. Dirk, I do know you have to leave early, so... But, Maureen, before we do, just in the last 48 hours, just as a kind of potential way forward that you might want to take back to your respective jurisdictions, there would be a way of really stimulating, I think, and encouraging and accelerating our work around the teaching profession, and that would be to simply make an announcement that you're about to invest $5 billion, US dollars, into the teaching profession. That's what President Obama has just announced, and it wouldn't be a bad thing, Maureen, given that you head up the whole of the international division for Secretary Arne Duncan, and therefore you are only one step away from the president. Could you just announce in a little bit more detail what this is, and could we determine very quickly whether we could apply? So, Maureen, just say a word.
Okay, just very quickly. I mentioned yesterday the new program that was announced just a day ago called RESPECT, and it is a new initiative in the U.S. to transform the teaching profession. It partially comes out of the International Summit last year, and it comes out of many activities that are ongoing about how to improve the quality and effectiveness of teaching in the U.S. And so what it is it's a dialogue initially that is led by classroom teachers in the United States, bringing together all of the different groups that are interested in and responsible for education, state leaders, teachers, teacher unions, et cetera, to talk about what it is that needs to happen to really elevate the teaching profession. And it comes out of the fact that in the U.S., you know, teaching is a highly respected and it's not a highly respected profession now, but it needs to be, that the importance of education is so key to the knowledge economy that we need to do more to elevate it to be a highly respected profession. And in doing that, to be sure that we have accomplished teachers in each of our classrooms and that we're moving along to be able to ensure that learning is high for all students, not just the strong students, but for everybody. And so it really comes from the fact that American teachers aren't really treated like professionals, that they often enter the classroom not that well prepared. They're not effectively supported when they're there. They're not necessarily adequately compensated, or that promotion is based on the quality of the teaching rather than number of years teaching or number of degrees. So this entails a radical transformation, certainly in our country, maybe not in all of yours, but for us. And along with the dialogue about how to move ahead, President Obama and Secretary Duncan announced a $5 billion competitive grant program.
And the idea is that we spend the next part of 2012 in the dialogue about how to structure that competitive program, and that the competitive program would be put into place in 2013. And it's really a competitive grant program that, unfortunately, Tony, is for the U.S.
Okay.
And but certainly the dialogue could be open to more than just the U.S. If I have some copies of the proposal there, and if you read it, you will see that our learning and our experience in the international arena has affected what's in the proposal, because we are very much looking at what other countries are doing. So in it really, that RESPECT stands for Recognizing Educational Success, Professional Excellence, and Collaborative Teaching, and that the competitive grant program would be for states and participating districts, or consortia of districts if states don't participate, to support them if they want to commit to pursuing a very bold reform on every stage of the teaching profession. So the key elements cover attracting top-tier talent into the program and preparing them well, creating a professional career continuum with competitive compensation, creating conditions for success, and this relates to looking at how the school year is arranged, how the school day is arranged, and saying what are ways that you can have the school system be more innovative to support teachers to really be able to teach the way they need to for each student. There would be an attention to evaluating and supporting teachers, being sure that teachers have the support they need to move ahead. If, despite support, teachers aren't strong, having pathways to decide how to address that. And getting the best teachers into the areas of highest need, including possibly additional compensation to get people into the high poverty areas, into helping children who don't speak English, special needs students, et cetera. And then what can be done to sustain the system. So really, this is bold, and it's taking on, I would say, mostly all parts of the education system, but very much in a way that's a collaborative way with teachers in the dialogue of help us collectively to think through what it is that needs to happen to meet these kinds of conditions, and to work together and hopefully build trust, strengthen the profession, and make teaching in the U.S. be a highly desired occupation for top students coming out of high school or coming out of college. And we'd love any thoughts you have. You'll have email addresses. You are both invited, and I'd love to hear from you about ideas you have related to these issues from an international perspective, and we'll certainly get them into the mix. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a few copies, so those who might like to access that, grab one, because they'll go by the time we get down to the back of the room, I think. Okay, thank you, Maureen. We should just acknowledge that Maureen is also the person who is really coordinating all of the preparation for the second New York Summit on the Future of the Teaching Profession that's held, will be held in mid-March, and people know about the 2011 summit, and the second, of course, now focusing upon three main areas in the profession, both the pre-service initial teacher training area that we have been talking about around tables over the last couple of days, questions around leadership, more broadly defined leadership rather than just institutional leadership, but teacher leadership and supply and demand issues. So a number of your ministers and a number of people in this room will be there, and maybe we can take up some of the points that you just raised, I think, around that table conversation over 2 days. This session is now in three parts and will take us through to the coffee break pre the final session starting at 4 o'clock. So we might take until 20 to 4, if that's an acceptable time. The three parts of this. One, we have a cast that could only be described really as a star-studded cast. Lawrence, were you saying something different?
Stella.
A stellar cast, right, who are in various ways going to address the third theme of our gathering, and that's around a professional future, or I guess in the language of the opening session, John, when we talked about threats and opportunities, and now having thought around nature of the profession, particularly in terms of how you measure teacher effectiveness and more broadly, no doubt, effectiveness of the whole learning enterprise, how would that come together in your mind about a desirable, preferred professional future? So part one is we're going to be stimulated by five short presentations. And you'll note I indicated short. They are of no more than 10 minutes each. And therefore, when I indicate that there is only 2 minutes to go, that's not a lack of courtesy. That is just simply a directive. So we're clear about that. The second part is we might just do a little bit of interrogation of our cast in terms of whether there are things you just want to get clear in your mind. So that's still a kind of PS to the first part. The second part, around each of your tables, this time, this will not be democratic. You are tasked in the space of 20 minutes to come up with what you see as being a desirable, at least, direction of travel, if not a preferred future, or perhaps even some characteristics of what you think would constitute a desirable way forward for the profession. And I know we've had debate about whether you even want to talk about this as being a profession. You can position that any way you like. But unlike John, who said that table-by-table report-backs are a thing of the past, they're dull, right, and people resist, that's exactly what's going to occur. Every single table will be made accountable. So you need to know that you will have literally 1 minute each in order to report back on a couple of features of what you see as being the desirable direction in thinking about the future of the profession. So that's part three. That's the set of arrangements which I know we've all agreed to in advance, which is great. Now, the panel, John Bangs is now clearly known to you. And from EI, John, you're going to lead off in a moment. I'm just going to do all introductions first. Professor Nina Basia from OISI is here. I'm sorry, and in fact, I've just changed the order here, so let me just go back and make it number two, right? So Gordana Mufic is actually from CEP. So Gordana, you're going to be number two. Philippa Cordingley is taking the third slot. And so, from Curie. Then, can I welcome Nina Basia from OISI, is the fourth. And David, you've got the graveyard shift. Okay, you're fifth on. So, we will stop just momentarily after each of the up to 10-minute presentations. So, if there's a point that people just want to have clarified, or if another member of our panel would like to do a quick interrogation, we can do that. Yeah? But we're going to do the whole thing within about 50 minutes. So here we go. John.
Right. Thank you, Tony. I fully respect your judgment about reports back from tables and will evaluate it accordingly. Actually, I just want to start off with the nature of social partnership, the role of unions, and along with my colleagues Guntars and David Edwards here, I want to say something about Bob Harris, who's here as well, who is my predecessor as chair of the Trade Union Advisory Committee Working Group on Education, Employment, Training at the OECD. And Bob knows, more than anyone else, a fundamental truth about the nature of social partnership, and that is teacher unions generally respond in the way in which they're treated. I think, Nina, that's the basis of your research as well, actually. And I'll give you a little anecdote to start off with. One of the finest examples of social partnership was when Bob received his farewell present from the Trade Union Advisory Committee, selected by Roland Schneider, a top Vigonier, I think you might describe it. They'd got the two best bottles in Paris, or so he thought, until he came up against Bernard Hugonier, the deputy director, who is also a master wine sniffer as well. And the debate between them about the quality of the wine was something else to... So that was real social partnership. I'm going to do some haikus because of the time. And the first is that I believe unequivocally in schools as social sites and as moral sites. And I get that from my own personal experience, from research, particularly Robert Alexander's research on primary education, the primary review, where actually children see schools as sites of optimism, and that actually that's where they make their friends, And schools are increasingly important as the sites in which children make their friends and their optimism is fostered. And teachers are key in fostering, in inverted commas, that social and moral optimism. So those who talk about simply delivery agents and that actually you can do it anywhere, you can do it virtually on the website, that isolating experience, completely devalue the centrality of schools as moral sites for society. That's my first point. Bearing that in mind, if that is the case, the extra responsibility on the teaching profession as a whole is really, really important. That actually teachers themselves understand that intuitively, because that's why they came into the teaching profession, to make a difference to children's lives, positively. And therefore, a strategy for the teaching profession is absolutely vital, which factors in that particular aspect as well. And we do need a systemic approach to teacher policy and teacher learning. And I was particularly taken by one of Ben Levin's papers, actually, where he says there is no evidence that actually devolution of responsibility to schools totally is better for standards and for the social development of children than a systemic centralised approach. And in fact, there are systems, particularly in Asia, which are very, very, in inverted commas, centralised, but are still achieving outstanding results. And in fact, actually, I identified in the paper that you received yesterday the elephant in the room, and that there is a poisonous synergy between governments who are absolutely up against it in terms of the fiscal crisis, looking at the argument for total devolution of responsibility of schools as a way out, that actually it will be down entirely to the principal to take decisions with smaller budgets without any systemic approach to the profession at all. And the one thing, with respect, and maybe I'm using it wrongly, but I'll check it out first with you, Gordana, I do believe that the effect of devolution is the balkanisation of the teaching profession, and that we have to have a conceptual approach to the teaching profession which is national in basis and global in basis, and not split off, as what we would say in England, into penny packets where the future for teachers is almost entirely defined by empowered principals, those powers being given to them by the central government, and who will act on as proxy in terms of government policy, and it's their responsibility to deliver, and all you've got is a punitive, overarching accountability agency. It seems to me to run entirely against the evidence about how systems become outstanding in terms of education. So, if we have a systemic approach to structures for the teaching profession, it seems to me that those structures need to be defined. You can't simply have a conceptual approach to the teaching profession, which is some kind of rather smoke and mirrors approach, which simply says the profession exists in an undefined way. There has to be structures. And the first structure, of course, is where does the profession share its learning? And is there a conceptualization about the profession's learning in the same way, and I got a lot from Philippa on this, actually, that actually we need to define a pedagogy for teachers in the same way as we need to define a pedagogy for children. And I've been enormously influenced by the work that Philippa has done on that. That actually if you define a pedagogy for teacher learning, and there's a lot of evidence out there, then you need to find ways of sharing that pedagogy within a systemic approach to teacher learning. That's the first thing, and that should be a very important construct of teacher policy. Secondly, and it's something that I've been floating since I was head of education at the NUT in the mid-90s, and it kind of fitfully appeared and disappeared, we need a bank or banks of professional knowledge controlled by the profession itself. That actually, at the moment, we're in silos of professional knowledge held by individual schools, seen as possibly highly valuable and can be sold as commodities. There has to be an ethos, an approach which actually shares professional knowledge about pedagogy, about teaching and learning. And the next thing, and I really do play tribute to Andrew Schleicher in terms of this and in terms of his relationship with the Teacher Unions and Education International. The background paper produced for the 2011 summit is state of the art, so far as I'm concerned, and it was a result of a genuine iterative relationship and a dialogue between ourselves and the OECD. The notion that you cannot have systemic, affected, embedded reform which works, the notion that you cannot have that without the buy-in from teacher unions, proactive teacher unions, is a very important notion, and I do pay tribute to Ben Levin for that as well, with his famous blog that he produced in 2010, in March 2010, on the OECD website. And that is something that's very new, and it's something to be built on. And you need to take into account the understanding that teacher unions will be respond in the way in which they're treated, my first point. My next point is we need to conceptualise the nature of teacher leadership itself. Teacher leadership, as David says, is not simply about, and there is a discussion about it, about posts that you can identify as teacher leaders. It is about a conscious knowledge that teachers have the capacity to lead in all the areas that they feel confident about. And teacher efficacy and how we enhance teacher efficacy should be on everyone's lips in policy terms. And finally, I think it's now the responsibility of unions to be the sites for professional discourse, discussion and professional development. As the state recedes from its responsibility, either under pressure or for ideological or political reasons, recedes in terms of its responsibility, the opportunity is there for unions to occupy that space. The opportunity is there for unions to occupy that space. And I pay tribute to the American unions, the NEA and the AFT, because they are doing that. And there are other unions doing it as well. And that is something that we need to research and evaluate, and I won't tread on Nina's toes any longer. And finally, there was an interesting discussion in my group yesterday about should we risk provider capture, i.e. if we give it to the profession, and actually we have an autonomous profession in charge of self-regulation, in charge of its own learning, operating a bank of professional development and professional knowledge, won't it mean provider capture? Actually, I don't think there's any other option. That is always a risk, but we've got to go for it. Thank you, Tony.
John, let me ask you this about your opening comment, and others might just want to come in as well. The question about positioning autonomy in the way that you did, I'm just reminded about the fact that this is also the home of David Hargreaves, and he's just been writing extensively for the National College in this country on a self-improving system. And the argument is that the new structure is not standalone autonomous sites, but in fact networks and clusters, and that networks and clusters as a structure will then be guided by a culture of local decision-making and co-construction supported by system leadership. Now, a question I want to ask you is, are you saying that how does the profession, right, not at the site level, but the profession, as you say, as a whole, how does the profession operate in a more network-based, cluster-based, with potential kind of intermediary agency operating, that itself is likely to be supported by a larger knowledge platform that everybody's talking about, that technology will allow. So I want to be clear that you are positioning this in a way that will accommodate the possibility for networks and clusters, that there will be a larger knowledge platform that we can connect to. Is that in any sense an awkward concept for you?
No, I mean, that's a very, very important. I'm glad you asked the question, Tony, because I mean, you just have to forgive me. So I'll talk a little bit about England. I know everyone's annoyed with the amount of space that England actually occupies, but on this one, I do think it's an important paradigm.
Well, by the way, this issue is one that's actually occupying multiple countries in terms of networks and intermediate tiers and,
My personal view is that the Secretary of State has reached a Faustian pact with principals and head teachers, and he said to the principals and head teachers of England, you deliver my reforms and I'll give you as much power as you need. That's the Faustian pact. The effect of that is the balkanisation of the teaching profession, and that they're identified in, they're simply, the outcome of that is that you will be in small groups in schools, and in a sense the relationship will be to do with the vast majority of heads will want a good relationship with their staff, but the opportunity to share a network will not be there. That's the worst case scenario. The solution to that is to have teaching schools. Teaching schools may ameliorate the effect of splitting up teachers into small groups, but actually they're an utterly inadequate response to a systemic need to link up the profession across the country. And in my view, it is up to teacher unions to work together to construct a professional council or provide professional councils themselves to actually provide the sites for teachers on a national basis, actually, if governments are not doing that.
Okay. Others want a quick question to John or a comment? Panel members will be reluctant to do this because it'll probably mean that they're going to use some of the material they're about to present. But, okay, I'm going to move then. So let me this time be right. Gordana, you are on. And Katie's going to operate the PowerPoint for you. Is that right, Katie?
Yep,
okay.
So my approach and my presentation has got a completely different view. It's a little bit pragmatical, not a little bit, it's completely pragmatical, and about things which are being going on not only in the Balkan, but also in the Southeast Europe. And one thing which I may say that the efforts in the Balkan are on de-Balkanizing teaching profession, on making people, making people in the Balkan cooperate more together. It work? Okay. So what? Good. So this is the structure of the presentation, and I will start with why do we do what we do, and our work in the Balkans is, or in the Southeast Europe, is strongly guided and based on the Open Society Foundation's mission in education, and this is, as already mentioned several times, on achieving education justice. So what am I doing wrong? Where do I have to put? That one, this little one. Okay, yeah, good. So I'm just going to skip that. But back in 2007 and 2008, there was a series of meeting with the education professionals, both from the civil society and the government, on defining the priorities which should be addressed by the Open Society Foundations in the Balkans or in the Southeast Europe. And they were defined as such: inequity in education, that is Balkanization, then an insufficient participation of stakeholders, particularly parents. We have already all knew that this is happening and that this is not going right, there is no true partnership. The parents are not involved in the school life as they should be, and that, and being so neglected category, we have decided to address exactly this issue. But now the point was how, whether to go to schools and to make some books or whatever. And the first step was to provide research-based evidence to see what actually parents think about their participation, what school principals think about involving parents in the school life. So the next step would logically be to strengthen the role of the parents, because we were assuming some of the results. And of course, who is the most important in the process? Who is the mediator and the link between the school and the community, between the school and the others, are the teachers. So the next point was to empower the teachers. And, as you can see, this is what teachers are expected to do. What we have heard here in many ways and being repeated many times, they have to be. So I put in green those capacities, so to speak, that correspond to the Open Society Foundation's mission in education. So that's it. But this is very well familiar to all of you, so I'm not going to read through those points. But research evidence collected by us shows the following situation in the Southeast Europe, which is individualistic teacher culture, which is promoted and which is both being manifested in the classroom and during the preparation for the training. And this is the result of the European Training Foundation research on the teachers for the future, the copy of which you, hard copy of which you have got outside. Teacher, parents' participation in the wider school development is very rare, result of two researches. Teacher education and the continuous professional development lack the skills and the capacities for communication with building school parents' communication and for social inclusion, which is very important. Parents' participation as it is, it's very formal, largely formal, perceived as desirable, but not much offered by schools. Those most in need, like the poor, the Roma, receive the least. And all of this is very well presented in the book. One of the authors is sitting with us, and you can also find outside. So these are the results of the research. So what can, and the quality assurance system not effective. So what we as the Open Society Foundations can do about it? You know, we are not the government, we are not World Bank, we don't have so much money. So what could be our response? So our response was a series of projects that built on each other. So one of those first projects was Advancing Education, Inclusion and Quality, which combined those two researches I have mentioned. Then building exactly on it after we have got the results was, okay, what can we do about these results? Let's see whether and what can work. So we have tried to include ethnic minority parents into the education using a teacher leadership model. And then teacher leadership model proved to be very successful in this small segment. So we have expanded it on a larger project that involved more countries and more schools and evolved into more topics than only building school-parent communication. And finally, the project that has just started is an attempt to bring it all together, to build on what has been done, to accumulate our knowledge and to provide the kind of the policy response for the teaching profession to build national qualification frameworks for the five Western Balkan countries. Geographically, this is how it looks like. So you have got the different colors showing where the projects are being implemented. So the largest ITL includes also Greece and Turkey, while Advancing Education, Inclusion and Quality has this big, you know, yellowish part. And the last one, the blue one, is we call it ATEPI or 8PI, which is Advancing Teacher Education Professionalism for Inclusive Education, for Inclusive Quality and Relevant Education. So you see that geographically they also overlap, and this is not accidental. We, in all those countries, we work with the we try to build on work which we do to involve the people which we have been working with to go on and to share the knowledge there. So this is a little bit about each of these projects. So you can just see some figures. Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to skip that because the presentation is going to be in the somewhere. Yeah. So, and what is very important is that International Teacher Leadership Project is formally finished, and this one is the most important for the development, but it is going on. You can see that the topics have spread to the increasing the motivation, inclusion of children, quality of teaching, nonviolence. There is a number of the examples, and there are new developments. So in Serbia, for instance, teacher leadership has been accredited as officially in service program. There are chances that it's going to be mainstreamed in Romania. New schools are asking to be included into the program in Croatia. So there is a lot going on. As I said, this project is the policy response on building the national qualification framework for the teachers, again, through the regional dialogue, and to promote cross-countries and inter-ethnic teachers' dialogue and networking. And this is, you know, the entire process, how we see the process going on, how it actually should go on. These are the main groups included: children and parents, educators and researchers, and the policy makers. And this is dynamic process with cooperation and synergy, which are more instrumental. But when I said with, I meant with those concerned, not for those concerned. With the teachers, for the teachers, with the teachers and parents, not for the teachers, by somebody else, which is usually happening. So quickly, some results related to ESP mission. Obviously, there are data that the social exclusion is reducing, at least in the schools who have been there, and this is spreading. Related to research-based evidence, there are definitely improvements. I'm just not going to go through all of them. But I would like to tell a few words about the added value or the added effects of all these projects. This is what I call snowball effect. You know, we have started with parents and then involved teachers, and now we have more schools, and the teachers are getting more empowered, and they would like to work more, and the parents are getting more visible in a way. For instance, in Serbia, we have just, there are in six municipalities, there are municipal parent councils, something what has never existed before. We also have in-depth data analysis because databases from those two surveys are really very rich, and now there are several scientific papers, not several, quite a number, I think about 20 scientific papers being published in various journals, researching and going more in depth of the in depth of all this process. And also our projects has been done informing EU design initiatives, and they have this is kind of the cooperation and the synergy between the projects promoted by OSF and the projects promoted by the European Union in our part of the world, so that we collaborate with each other, build on each other data, and work together toward more teachers' professionalism through networking, peer learning, and learning from each other. Yep. Thank you very much.
Well done, great. Thank you. Well, just as you're going back to your seat, and as Philippa gets herself ready, I don't want to make a false distinction here, John, but when I could listen to your presentation, I get a sense of a profession-led learning future. That mightn't be quite the way in which you would position it, but just hold that for 1 second. Gordana, if I was thinking about a profession-led learning future, when I hear you talk, there is a strong sense, OSF, and it strikes me that this is going to be an interesting part of our conversation, when you get others in the learning game providing leadership, whether it be philanthropists or social entrepreneurs or NGOs or corporates, I think it becomes a really interesting debate. And then I hear from you a kind of partnership-led learning future. And when you had that diagram that had the policymakers, the educators, the researchers, the parents, and the children, if there was one thing I heard you say many times, it was a connection to parents and the community. So I just want to know whether, how would you simplistically, and this might be not a good ask of you, but do you draw a distinction between a profession-led future for learning, right, and compared to what it is that you position? How would you describe in a kind of sentence the way in which you are thinking about it? Is that a client partnership? What is it?
You cannot make dichotomy here. Okay. I mean, it's not profession-led. It is. It might be said professionally led, but taking into account the voice and the needs and the future of the children.
Okay. Yes. Others want to do a quick intervention? Thank you. People are desperate to hear you, Philippa. You are on.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start with a joke about not telling a joke, but Alicia did that so beautifully last night that I think I just want to start by saying how much I've enjoyed listening to and learning with you all, and hope I feel very humble about what I've got to say, but very much look forward to unpicking it with you. And it starts with a question about how the evidence about the nature of an environment for teacher professional learning can help us construct a dynamic future for the profession within the context that Gordana and John have said and the other presentations have. And in particular, I want to think about in detail the specifics of teacher professional learning's contribution to rising to the challenges so eloquently put in John's wonderful paper and the other presentations we've had. It connects with Dirk's point about knowledge, but I'm kind of trying to push us beyond knowledge into learning. And I want to say we do have a very mature and established evidence base about the nature, first of all, of professional development. And this comes from very careful, systematic reviews. And I want to just notice that the first funder of these large-scale systematic reviews was actually a teacher professional association. It was the National Union of Teachers under John's leadership. And in this country, other professional associations, particularly the General Teaching Council, which is a slightly different body, started to fund that. Government came on the scene later. The New Zealand government also helped. So we have a series of very large-scale, technical, all carried out double-blind, systematic, large-scale reviews of the international evidence about what makes a difference in teachers' professional development learning, not just to the teachers, but to young people. And most recently, we have a more fine-grained review that looks specifically at the role of teachers engaging with their own and in their own research and with the research of other people in teaching as compared to health and social services. And actually, the story about health is not the one you'd expect, so interesting things there. I'm saying we've got an evidence base, and I want to just rehearse it to remind us about this, because I think there are some paradoxes we can make use of. First of all, whenever we've got large-scale evidence about benefits for teachers and for young people, we always have evidence about the drawing down by teachers of specialist expertise. And that specialist expertise functions in several different ways. First of all, teachers are using specialists to be sure they're identifying high leverage strategies, but also to match those, and to learn how to evaluate and match those to the needs of the young people they're working with. Specialists are important in helping teachers to see the art of the possible, to see new approaches and phenomena in action in various different contexts and different modes. Specialists are helping teachers in providing feedback about their early experiments, but the form of feedback is very important, and people like Bruce Joyce now challenge the notion of feedback and talk about debriefing instead. And the other thing specialists are skilled at and that teachers are looking for from the specialists who work with them is skills in making themselves redundant and in building the teacher's own control over their own learning in a gradual scaffolding process. But what we also have in the evidence, and there is much more evidence about this and evidence of needing more of it, is teacher peer learning. And again, we're beginning to be able to theorize and understand some principles underneath that, as well as have large scale empirical evidence about why this is important. Particularly key is teachers using each other to sustain the momentum in prodding and poking and refining what they've learned from specialists in day-to-day contexts. And above all, reciprocal vulnerability. Reciprocal vulnerability between teachers lengthens our arms in learning. Because when teachers take the risk of looking silly together in trying out new things and unlearning things, they become committed to supporting each other. And you see this time and again in the evidence. Reciprocal vulnerability is fantastic at speeding up the trust needed to unlearn and learn with authenticity and to try very new things. And we also know that peer support is key and linked to ownership of professional learning amongst conscripts just as much as natural enthusiasts or even convertible skeptics. We know there are a whole series of other things here. Professional dialogue, this is not any kind of conversation. We see it linked in particular to two things. We see it as dialogue about trying out new things, disturbing the status quo. We see it also as being very importantly linked to working out not just how things work or that they work or don't work, but to understanding why they do and don't in different contexts. Actually, practical theory underpinning rationale is a hugely central part of effective professional dialogue. It follows, therefore, that you get inquiry-oriented learning, learning to learn from observing. We have in this country a plethora, an enormous amount of learning walks. Some of it, frankly, is casual tourism, and the learning is not great or deep. Some of it is very powerful, and very often the difference between those two is the extent to which teachers get the opportunity to learn how to learn from looking. That too, is a skill. And the other thing we see in all this evidence is tools. Now, this kind of CPD, the first thing anybody does is give it a smart name. And, you know, sometimes it's collaborative inquiry, sometimes it's coaching, tutoring, conferencing. Broadly, it tends to come under umbrellas of mixtures of coaching, specialist coaching and peer coaching, mentoring, collaborative inquiry, and co-construction. In English, we have a saying that what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. What I think we have here is the same situation for teachers that we were in 10 years ago about the learning of pupils. We spent far too much time looking at the teaching of young people and not enough looking at their learning. In the last 10 years, thanks to people like the National Union of Teachers starting this work on reviewing the literature, we've learned to concentrate more effectively on the CPD for teachers. But at our peril, do we leave that there as being about the teaching of teachers? What we need to concentrate on is what the nature of professional learning looks like. If we can make professional learning a key priority for everyone who seeks to make a viable future for teachers, then I think we're getting somewhere in rising to some of the challenges. And there's a little booklet on our website called Sauce for the Goose, and it's got a very good recipe for sauce for goose in it, actually, and it works very well with duck as well. Okay, so we have an evidence base about teacher professional learning. One thing we found in this, I just want to issue a warning, we were asked to translate this into a national framework for mentoring and coaching, and we identified the skills of teachers in making good uses of their coach and mentors as much as the skills of coaches. But when we interviewed teachers after they'd been coached, they were full of praise for the coach. They were almost silent on what they brought to the learning. And actually, what they brought to the learning was infinitely greater and richer than the support from the coach, however good that was. So one of the things we're starting to do now is find national tools and frameworks so that we put power in teachers' hands so they interrogate their coaches, that they ask open questions when they don't know what they don't know, and closed ones when they want to signal to their coach they're taking control of their own learning and to direct the coach's attention. So if we were to use this evidence to form the future for profession as one of a series of key priorities, what would leaders be doing? Fortunately, we have another large-scale systematic review to help us here. I don't know how many of you are aware of Vivian Robinson's best evidence synthesis on leadership. Some, not everyone. Okay, I'll quickly go into that. Correlations about the most effective contributions of school leadership. There are the five things that she found correlating. I've worked with over 2,000 school leaders in this country and in Italy, and asked school leaders to identify what was the most effective contribution that the school leaders were making and put them in ranking order. Three people got it right. Actually, it's investing in promoting and participating in teacher learning that has twice the effect of any other contribution. This is a really powerful part of what we need to understand to make a future for profession that has professional learning at its center. And then the last part of this piece is to think about what that means about schools as creating the conditions for professional learning that create the dynamic future we're all looking for. And one of the things we're beginning to see is that we need to think about effective learning environments for staff as well as for pupils as exploring a series of dimensions. We need to understand the ways in which schools are good at recognizing, identifying, and drawing through specialist expertise amongst their own staff and from outside. We need to understand the way schools approach collaboration as a learning strategy, not just for young people, but for the professionals within it. And I thought Gordana's wonderful telling example about learning through collaboratively in partnership with parents and the wider community too. we need to understand the ways in which schools use not just pupil outcome data, but rich evidence about pupil learning and the learning process of teachers and pupils through videos. I thought Ron's example had something very powerful to offer us earlier. How schools are using evidence to enrich and sustain and embed learning. How schools, in effect, offer assessment for learning as a learning tool for teachers in the same way that they do for pupils. And the final point there is about the leadership of professional learning and development, the way leaders model, invest in, align school and individual needs, link pupil and staff learning, and select and structure tools in order to embed that. I think if we put everything we know about pupil learning, turn it through a few degrees to apply it to schools, if school leaders started to think, as Helen Timperley says, about the staff as their class, we could make quite a lot of progress quite quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Philippa. Fantastic. I've got to ask you this question just as Nina is getting set up. Yep. I think that, John, you referred to Richard Elmore in your opening. There was a moment when a few of us were together, as it turns out, in London, and Elmore made the argument that we're a profession without a practice. Now, what I just heard from you is that is so far from the truth. We are an evidence-based profession. We know an enormous amount about effective professional practice, and we are increasingly committed collaboratively, the CT in respect, collaborative teaching. We are increasingly committed to collaborative and ongoing professional learning, and we should feel very confident about that as a profession. And Lawrence asked a question at the table in the session before lunch and said, what is it that has prevented other people from investing the confidence in our profession to take forward and lead learning? Now, if we are in the place that you say we are, and we've got synthesis now of a kind that really give you a confidence about we know what we're doing, why are we not more influential? If we could be a collaborative, evidence-based, professionally practice-led around learning, what's your quick cut on why this is not the story that we hear?
Well, in this country, the fact that only 3 out of all those 2,000 school leaders got anywhere close to understanding what that evidence says, and actually were completely outraged about the results, I think tells you quite a lot.
So actually, going back to John's point about the fact that you actually, we got terrible knowledge transfer across the profession of what we actually know, which therefore leads to the problem about the individualistic teacher operating in ways which doesn't have the power of the profession behind them and constantly learning. Exactly. I mean, this is a pretty major block for any kind of future.
But it's our fault too, because we've talked about the CPD we do to teachers, and that's been the focus. And actually, that was a breakthrough, because before that, we were just completely ignoring the teacher and running in, you know, rubbish chalk and talk days.
Others?
Can I just ask Philippa just one thing about the evidence? It's my understanding, but I may be wrong, that most of the evidence that comes from those studies are self-report. It's either head teachers saying... There's very few studies that actually sit and look at the processes of what are going on. And those studies that do, to a certain extent, have problems about the nature of some of that dialogue.
All of the best evidence synthesis studies and our studies had pre and post absolute minimum, but usually with... control group, experimental evidence. So, and it's not self-report. The tests of these studies to get through this are very big. But the thing that the CPD studies mostly don't get into these reviews, because the CPD studies are self-report. It's when you've got evidence about large-scale interventions that also problematizes this continuing professional development and the learning behind it that you get to this evidence. So I would say you're absolutely right. If you look at most of the literature about CPD per se, it's when you look at the evidence about CPD within other larger scale change studies that you get to this evidence.
Okay, thank you.
Philippa, thanks very much. I have a question
I think it's a question of time. It's something we think about and write about a lot and create. I mean, there's certainly a lot of evidence here about the roles of tools. I mean, micro-inquiry tools, questioning frameworks, protocols, rather than summaries of stuff. But certainly, I think tools and artifacts and protocols are writ large across this evidence. So simply time.
Could I just make a quick observation that I think the mention of leadership there focuses on school principals, and it seems to me we have to ask questions about how leadership permeates schools as communities, because teachers actually do an awful lot of leading of each other's learning, and I think if we look at that more closely, we can see there's room for more optimism.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you. Nina.
Thank you. Is this on?
It is.
Okay, so no slides. My talk is on the role of teacher unions in the future of the teaching profession. So we're doing a bit of a segue here. Teacher unions have come up now and then in our conversations over the last day and a half as important in terms of teachers' collective voice and in terms of being a conduit between teachers and government, teachers and the public. I've been doing research on teacher unions in North America for the last 25 years, and I'm one of a very small number of researchers who look at teacher unions, and an even smaller number of researchers who don't automatically assume that teacher unions are bad. So I could tell you stories, but I won't do that here. So what are the prospects for the future if we're, you know, John's last point, or at least it was in the draft before this one, that, you know, teacher unions are our salvation. What are the prospects for that? It's pretty clear. We know that when formal education officials initiate educational reform, teacher unions are often absent from the table. They're just not part of the reform picture. They were established after and in reaction to the formal educational structures that we take for granted now. And they were not viewed as legitimate decision makers. And their actions and comments are often viewed as antithetical and obstructive to good educational practice. This is what the literature says. But there are also strong arguments that teacher unions are critical to educational improvement because through their teacher members, they provide important system feedback as well as necessary expertise and providing an essential balance where bureaucracy and hierarchy threaten to mitigate against good educational practice. So while a number of educational jurisdictions around the world have moved to outlaw or severely reduce the power of teacher unions' influence, others appear to have maintained relatively stable, positive working relationships. And we have a number of countries and states, provinces, that experience a kind of a cyclical movement between denial and recognition of the work that teacher unions do. And currently, witnessing the summit, we're in a period of international recognition of the importance of unions' collaborative relations with government, and a time when the time may be right to develop a better understanding of the nature of those positive relationships. I would say that the overarching pattern in the research is one of antipathy between teacher unions and governments, and this seems to be fundamental to many educational systems. In the U.S., the U.K., and Canada, mass public education was conceived on the basis of designs borrowed from military and factory organization, and was strongly bureaucratic and hierarchical and controlled by an educational elite in government. Teacher unions emerged in response to these developments in order to change, to challenge the low status, low pay, and poor working conditions that characterize these systems. So unions have always existed in response to, in reaction to, at least fundamentally. And they've been viewed as illegitimate and obstructive in relation to efficient educational delivery and in relation to system master plans. And if you look in the newspaper any day, this is very much what we see. Collective bargaining is pretty limited in terms of what unions are allowed to talk about on teachers' behalf. And this tension, the reason I'm mentioning this history is that this tension, which I think is very fundamental, has continued to exist, and it continues to hinder our ability to imagine a different future for teacher unions. Once in a while, we see an interest in establishing partnerships between union and educational jurisdictions. This happens usually when there's some tipping point that's been reached and it becomes clear that not involving teachers is really hampering the quality of educational delivery. So some of the examples I'm aware of in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. include trust agreements and learning partnerships in the U.S., the social partnership, which is problematic but is certainly an example of a partnership in the U.K. What these initiatives have in common is an emphasis on developing the relationship through the vehicle of a collaborative focus on reform. And what most of them have in common is a lack of durability. There's too much emphasis, I would say, on fostering relationships among individual leaders and too little emphasis on addressing fundamental educational problems. The pervasiveness of the scientific management paradigm in broader educational systems can be stronger and more challenging than partnerships can endure. Not only do educational officials revert to rejecting the legitimacy of union involvement, unions themselves may be unable to rise above reacting along old paradigmatic lines. And I've thought over and over the last day and a half, we're stuck in old paradigms. We need new paradigms. And this is an example. I have not been able to find any research on the presence and nature of positive union government partnerships. There's a small body of evidence on the characteristics of teacher unions that remain responsive to their own members, work on important educational reform issues, and manage to persuade the public and government to support rather than undermining teachers and shaping educational policy and practice. These characteristics, these are the positive unions, include developing an alternative educational paradigm that articulates a coherent understanding of the positive relationships between conditions of teaching and quality of student learning, between policy and practice, and the ability to persuade not only their teacher members, but also others of the legitimacy of this new paradigm. They also pay attention to their internal organizational structures and positive relationships with their members so that teachers are driving and believe they are driving union actions, and unions are simultaneously tending to teachers' direct needs for professional learning and involvement in decision making. Third related characteristic concerns the nature of actions teacher unions undertake out in the world, not only lobbying and collective bargaining, but also taking on the task, and I think I'm picking up on somebody's point earlier, about building system infrastructure that otherwise would not exist. Either it had never been envisioned or it has disappeared in difficult economic times. I've got lots of examples. If we're interested in looking at positive working relationships between unions and governments, and that's something that I hope to do over the next year or so, we need to look at the paradigms that underlie governments and teacher unions' actions, both independently and relationship to one another. The more comprehensive and coherent the paradigm, the greater likelihood of sustained relationships, and the more likely that the partnership will engender substantive reform. And this paradigm can be deduced from the discursive practices of involved participants on both teacher union and government sides, just listening to what people have, the way that people talk about what's important. The centrality of the issues and projects undertaken in partnership. The breadth of involvement or communications channels among active partners and others. For example, the active involvement of teachers and not just union officials in these important activities, in the issues and projects undertaken. The sustained and flexible nature of the partnership over time and in relation to environmental challenges, and the capacity to respond effectively to adverse situations, the capacity to tolerate and to work through differences in perspective, and structural arrangements that support the above. The most important and fundamental thing we need to do is to construct new paradigms to replace old ones. And that's just true across the board, and it's true in terms of teachers' organizations.
Nina, thank you. Let me ask you this. Given this has got to be beyond antipathy, beyond old paradigms of partnership, is the future of the new paradigm with us? Have you seen the future?
I have seen the future. I've seen a very small number of examples of the future. I've seen instances where teacher unions working under very adverse circumstances have been able to develop a whole new discourse about education and persuade not only their members but the public to think about teaching and learning in completely different ways. I've seen unions take on very important and enduring projects that nobody else has taken on. I've seen unions that, lots and lots of examples of unions that are test beds for all kinds of educational innovation. So there are bits and pieces of the future that we see now, and the trick is finding ways of sustaining and broadening these kinds of efforts.
One example of the future where beyond the nature of the professional discourse within the profession itself amongst members and beyond a new discourse with community, what about with government?
That's something that I'm hoping to study. I think probably some of the best examples we'll see are a kind of a willingness to continue working and taking different kinds of positions rather than looking to live together happily ever after.
John, can I say, just before David comes in, this reminds me of the conversation, Maureen, around the summit table last year, and that if we were in the middle of Europe right now, in different parts of Europe, the social compact between, which I know is a variation of what you were saying, Nina, about the nature of the relationship in terms of social agreements or partnerships or whatever, but a social compact or contract is actually a feature, John, of a number of countries. So I take it when you talk about your vision for the future, you are drawing strength from what you see from other places can be already a powerful example.
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Tony. First of all, there's not a piece of paper between me and Gordana. I profoundly believe in schools as communities, and that actually self-confident teachers will have a whole range of partners, parents, academic communities, and vitally and more crucially than ever, global connections with other sites, other schools, et cetera, et cetera. So there's not a piece of paper, and I do find the work that's taken place in the Balkans. Gordana gave me post hoc permission to use that word, actually. So anyway, I find the work that's taken place, largely the ITL project, absolutely inspiring. And that actually focuses on a massive hike in teacher self-efficacy. That's the fundamental thing to understand about the ITL project. It is about saying to teachers, actually, you've got permissions and you can do anything. You've got a whacking great contribution to make. Do it. Yep. Do it collectively. And I do pay tribute to the ITL project. Now, to answer your question, I'm glad that Nina is coming to the second summit, because I am slightly less pessimistic than you are, Nina, about teacher unions and governments. There are a number of examples which are not perfect. And where I do fundamentally agree with Nina is that actually those trade union officials or teacher union officials who have a cozy relationship with governments are not understanding the nature of pluralism. That seems to me fundamental, actually. That to use that wonderful phrase, we all have our audiences, and the dynamic that drives unions are no different to the dynamic that drives business. You have to retain your members, and they voluntarily pay money, and if they don't like what you're doing, they'll leave. So, you know, the reality is, the trick is, as Nina says, is to have a systemic approach to your own union, which enhances and empowers members, and to provide the site. You have to provide the conditions for change inside your own union to provide the conditions for change outside the union, basically. Yep. So there you go.
Peter.
Yes, Peter Brown, University of Cambridge. I'm interested in the relationship between teacher unions and the profession. Does a teacher have to be a member of a union to be a member of the teaching profession? And if the answer to that question is no, what is the role of unions in relation to the profession?
Would you like to have that as a question on notice? Or do you want to have an immediate crack at it?
I can come back at the end if there's time on that.
Oh, no, there will be time.
Oh, right, OK.
But
I look
so
forward
would you
to
prefer
it then. But I'm
to
just
come
conscious
back on
of
it?
I'm just conscious of David and, you know, I just...
but I tell you what, I think we're OK on time. So
OK, well, I'll come back if you
want. Yeah, we'll be fine. Yeah, do
I, you know, I, we Nina turned up to, and we had a lovely supper seminar in Cambridge in February, and it was a super seminar, actually, well attended. And... But there was one head teacher said, the things that Nina describing, I don't recognise. They're all stroppy, and they all say no in my school, et cetera, et cetera. And I am certainly not starry-eyed about unions. But what I am probably over Panglossian about, maybe, but, I mean, you've got to have a bit of vision, Peter, you know, is actually, I have seen amazing things when trust is shown by those who are responsible, whether or not it's governments or head teachers or whatever, and they are also prepared to take the turbulence and the bumpiness when actually the response is not as they anticipated. Be grateful to me, and you're not grateful, and I won't persist. Actually, if you believe in enhancing, empowering your staff, you take the bumpiness with you, but it does actually require from leaders a vision which says, I can do so much more if I'm working with people rather than simply telling them what to do, actually. So that's my view about unions in relation to governments as well. Governments do have that attitude, and they'll take the bumpiness, and they'll understand the nature of pluralism, actually are going to be much nearer outstanding education systems.
So the answer to my question
the answer to your questions are that actually there has to be, and I think it's very much actually what Nina said, there has to be a far more fundamental understanding through governments and unions about the nature of pluralism and the relationship between unions and government. And there has to be a theory. I mean, there's a lovely phrase, and I haven't yet given the reference to Nina, but there's a wonderful book written, one by a Swedish academic whose name I've forgotten, but also the English academic. But it's boxing and dancing. And that actually sometimes you box with government and sometimes you dance. And there is a theoretical basis for that. You know.
This is going to be worth exploring. Nina, did you want to come back to Peter as well?
No.
No? Okay. I've got Bob and then Ron. Is that okay? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to Peter because I think it's a very pertinent question. I think that unions, teachers' unions, can and should provide professional leadership. That doesn't mean that, taking a very specific question he asked, that they have to oblige people to be members. They should attract membership on their merits. I've always advocated that. I think most of the affiliates of Education International have come to that view these days. That's part of the debate that we had when we created Education International almost 20 years ago. But it's followed its course, and I think that the key to it is that unions can provide professional leadership. They should do it in partnership with parents. They should seek partnership with government. And government, hopefully, will be responsive to that leadership. It's not always the case. There's a lot of hard work to be done to actually make it happen in practice. But events and activities and initiatives like the summit, I think, have taken us a long way down that road, just as this seminar has been.
Thank you. Ron?
This is a direct follow-up on that from Peter's. And Nina, you probably can't answer it because you weren't there, but maybe you can speculate, and John and Tony can possibly answer it. One of the things that really surprised me at the summit last year, just to give everyone an image, the countries and the delegates were in an inner circle table, and then there was observers around. And the observers, which were mostly U.S. people, there were a number of teachers there, U.S. state teachers of the year. And at the table were primarily, they were the ministers and the union leaders. And just because of numbers, there were probably more union people at the inner circle than ministers. So one of the state teachers of the year stood up and said, well, here we go again. Big meeting about teaching, and there are no teachers at the table. And I looked at him, and I know him, and he's a member of the Birds Union. In fact, and I thought, what are you talking about? Your union leaders are here. Which, you know, she wasn't Margarita said it, so mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is that about? This is that relationship between unions not in government, but unions
yeah.
are in members.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Well,
Nina, have a go.
I will speculate about that. It really takes a very special union to do what is needed to persuade its members that it's their organization. And most unions, unfortunately, don't do that. They try to figure out the lowest common denominator in terms of what they're negotiating for. They don't have enough conduits to enough important kinds of activities and conduits to decision-making for the diversity of their members. And so for many teachers, unfortunately, the union belongs to somebody else. It's not them.
Even though they're members.
Even though they're members.
David, John privileged the work of OECD and Schooling for Tomorrow. I know that at the end of that 10 years, as we segued into what is now a major CERI project around innovative learning environments, that we got to a sharp end, John, about scenarios not just about the future of schooling. We actually have a number of unpublished scenarios that David wrote about the future of the profession. They've never been published. And in fact, I don't know that they've ever been publicly shared. So, David, this is a prompt to make sure that in the spirit, I think, of Nina's point about new paradigms and to help us get into a space where we want to certainly take the future of the profession and the future of learning to something stronger than we have at the moment, that we ought to be a little open to new possibilities. I'm assuming you're going to inject a futures spirit into your 10 minutes. And if you don't, we'll be very disappointed.
Thank you, Tony. That's a very confidence-inspiring introduction. I'm not going to do those three things because there isn't time. But I'll try and do the first and the third, which is response, I think, Tony, to your invitation. I'll start with the work that is more recent, and come back to the work on Schooling for Tomorrow, which was from some time in the past. So first of all, to try and to report on conclusions emerging from our ongoing and, to my mind, very interesting reflections around innovative learning environments. You can see there that we're looking at learning research, we're looking at particular cases of innovation, and we're beginning to think more and more about how one grows innovative learning environments. That's the nature of the activity. But the part that is most advanced is the first one, the learning research, the nature of learning, using research to inspire practice. And we came to a number of conclusions from that review of the nature of learning that I think really was the origins of our involvement in this particular seminar, because there was a lot of interest from Education International about that particular report and an invitation for us to become more engaged in it. So I'd like, first of all, to give some sense of what those conclusions were. We sought to arrive at a very small number of what we called principles emerging from a very wide-ranging a review, and then to think about what implications those might well have for teachers and for a professionalism. And here there were seven. The first one was that a learning environment really should make learning central. It is about encouraging engagement of learners, and it's a place where learners come to understand themselves as learners. It's very much about ensuring and understanding that learning is something that is social and will often be most effective when it is a collaborative. It's an environment which is really highly tuned to emotions and motivations. It's an understanding that the emotional side of learning, the anxiety, avoiding the negatives, the anxieties, the feelings of ridicule and so on, and encouraging the positives, the satisfactions, the self-efficacy, is as much a part of the learning as the cognitive development itself. It's about a sensitivity to differences, to individual differences, including in prior learning. The more that the learning environment is able to reflect on and be sensitive to such differences, the more effective it is. And as part of that, needs to be really demanding for each learner. This, in a sense, is a very much a personalization agenda. Be demanding, but without excessive overload. So no coasting, but at the same time, nobody so stretched that they really cannot cope. A point that's been made a number of times throughout the last day and a half about the importance of assessment, and that assessment is very much consistent with the aims of the learning, with a strong emphasis on formative feedback, but not exclusively so, but certainly that the evaluation and assessment should be consistent with the aims of the learning, and that there should be a promotion of connectedness across activities, across subjects, connectedness across the learning that goes on in and out of school, and that, moreover, there should be all of these present in a really effective learning environment. Now, in the note you have, it's in the dossier, it's the third of the OECD contributions from Dirk and Kristen, and then the third one's from myself. I recast those seven principles in a way around teachers and teaching and teacher professional. And somewhat what I think Philippa invited us to do is to turn it round, yeah, to think about what that means in terms of teacher activity, teacher learning. Yeah. That was a very speculative, interesting to do, but not necessarily a very profound exercise. But I think that is an interesting route to follow. Here, in a somewhat different way, I've thought what coming out of those seven principles are some of the nature of the professionalism that is implied. Fairly understandably, I think there is an importance of understanding the subject matter, to be comfortable with the teachers, being comfortable with what they're teaching, so that they can really use it in ways to optimize learning. And the importance of having a rich repertoire of teaching strategies and the ability to use different strategies depending on different circumstances, and knowing when to do that. Again, something I think that Philippa very helpfully outlined. Perhaps moving on somewhat, I think the importance perhaps of teachers really understanding the nature of learning and of their students, I think including motivations, including the broader lives of their students. The importance of being able to work in highly collaborative ways, working and learning in highly collaborative ways. I think there is an importance of technology skills, both because of the richness of digital resources that are available and open to use by teachers, but also to navigate successfully in terms of all the information that there is available on learning, how to navigate efficiently and effectively, and the capacity to create and shape learning involving particularly design and leadership. So as well as individual competencies, individual skills, I think it's important to think through some of those more a collective dimensions of the professionalism in terms of the importance of working in highly collaborative ways, for example, and the ability to design and to be leaders as well. Now, I'm going to skip that. That's the bit I said, Tony, I was going to skip. Yeah. But to come on to the scenarios. They've been mentioned a number of times. We in SERI have a sort of running brief, really, to look more to the future than perhaps throughout the rest of our work in education at OECD. That's a privilege we have in our centre. We exercised that in the past in the Schooling for Tomorrow project. It involved scenarios, trends, futures thinking, a variety of activities. And the schooling scenarios themselves have been mentioned, and John put them up yesterday, delighted, as I said in the note, to think that they still have some currency, particularly because they were actually written and devised quite a long time ago now. But in fact, I think their value has been that they have been used and adapted and over the years. There are six, and in the paper I elaborate right at the end that I think it's perhaps quite useful to really distinguish between children between the age, say, of 3 and 12, 13, and what kind of scenario we think is suitable for them, and older, the adolescents, the teenagers, where there might be much more variegated provision. That's a position at the end of the paper that I outlined, because I think it's potentially important, though, of course, everyone can disagree with that. But I think that's to put those scenarios up. Where we think we're going in terms of the future of education, I think very importantly shapes where we think we're going in terms of the teachers and the nature of professionalism and the profession itself. So what I'd like to conclude on is a scenario set that, as Tony says, we developed out of a workshop now several years ago in Cardiff in 2007, but we never really built on. I won't go into why we didn't. There was no particular story there, but perhaps now it's very nice to be able to go back and to pick those up and to see whether they do have the start of a of a basis of a reflection that might actually be worth reflecting on more. The four that we came up with were really, we wanted these four scenarios to be positive ones. Positive ones in the sense that they weren't going to include, for example, the meltdown scenario. Yeah. And everyone would say, well, we don't want to do that. These were, wanted them to be, in some sense, positive scenarios. And the first one was really one where teachers were very similar, very much saw knowledge and pedagogy as their domain. They have the monopoly of the learning environment, and though and they do not see working with other professionals and paraprofessionals and other other people involved in the lives of young children as being particularly their concern, but they're jolly good at what they do. That was one scenario that came out of the that reflection. The second one is really to say something the same, except that the understanding of what the what it is to be a teacher, the nature of the professionalism, has to be a good deal broader than that, and it has to involve working much more with different adults, different professionals, in being a teacher. So there's less of a sense of a monopoly and less of a sense of being very strongly focused on knowledge as the exclusive core of that professionalism. This scenario, in a sense, is, could be seen as consistent with either of those two, but where there's as a solar system, the teacher as the, if you like, the really highly professional expert in the middle, but around which is circled a whole set of different professionals, different adults, in a workforce that is quite clearly devised in that way. So this differs as a scenario in the extent to which the relationship between the teachers and those other many people engaged in education is made much more explicit. And then the fourth one was to say, well, if we are moving towards networks, if we are moving towards personalized educational services, bringing in all kinds of different consultants, different experts, then perhaps what we're looking at is a scenario with where there are many, many professionals, but there's no actual profession. The profession itself disappears. There isn't a teaching profession. Now, of course, that's just the start of a conversation. Scenarios are never, they're not predictions. They're not complete. But there's a sense there, I think, of asking some questions about what are we looking at as a whole that we might be moving towards in the future. And perhaps these give a start of that kind of framework. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, just leave that one there for a moment because we think this might be a useful catalyst for a roundtable conversation. John, I just want to check in with you on this. The planning committee labelled the third session towards a professional future. Okay? Now, I don't want to get into a kind of exegesis over this, but you decided not to label it towards a learning future. Involving the profession. I want to be clear about this because there are those at the moment who are saying the debate, one, ought to be around learning futures and then the role that the profession will play along with many others. There are those in the last day and a half that have said the prior question is the nature of the learning place. So we've had the debate around the school, and Tony argued yesterday that we need to bottom that out a little more, although you entered the space today by simply declaring that the school as place, both as social site and moral site, is in fact not to be debated or negotiated. I took that as... No, well, you didn't quite go that far. But there was a strong statement. So I'm wanting to be clear that a number of us might say, well, we'd prefer a different conversation at this point rather than toward a professional future. But that the conversation that we're charging you with is precisely that. From the conversations over the last day and a half and from the panel where you've heard, one, I think, a commitment obviously to learning, a commitment to the place of learning, we are wanting to think about what the professional future might be that you see as most desirable. So can we be clear that we've had different views about the role of the union in a professional future? We've certainly talked about the profile of the professional in the way that I think probably Philippa, you and David have picked up on. And we've certainly had a question about the role of the community in supporting the professional endeavour. This was to be a stimulus to say, if over the next 15, 20 minutes, could you at the table identify a couple of dimensions or features of what you see as being a desirable professional future? And what I'm trying to encourage you to do is not necessarily to debate again whether you'd prefer to be having a conversation about the future of school or whether you'd prefer to be having a conversation about the future of learning. We understand that that's all part of it. We're actually asking you to have a conversation about toward a professional future. What does that look like? And I do want to bring a microphone around to tables and just say, give me a couple of the headlines of your conversation. What are the features? What are the characteristics? What's the sense of direction? Okay? So that's the challenge that we're going to give to you. But before we do, a couple of other comments.
I just wanted to ask David to clarify two scenarios. I understood you as saying that the knowledge professional where the teacher is concerned with teaching their subject, and that may not be sufficient, but we recognize that as where the teacher is. But I didn't get what you meant by the extent.
In the first one, the if you like, the what goes on within the professional sphere of the teacher who has a monopoly, really, over what monopoly as individuals or collectively of what goes on in that sphere is it's very much a monopoly, and it's very much focused on teaching in terms of a focus on specialised professionalism, on knowledge itself. In the second one, the understanding, the broader understanding, if you like, of a broader role in terms of the different demands on young people, the broader lives of young people, the going beyond teaching the subject, so to speak, towards the professional that's dealing with young people in all their learning is broader. So it's a distinction, really, between how wide do we think the teacher's remit is? And that came out of our discussions in the workshop.
Others? Tony?
Anything I would say, Tony, yeah. The title of the whole seminar is The Future Of, Not The Future For the Teaching Profession. So there's an important distinction there.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Thank you. Okay. Tony?
I'm not sure whether this is a red herring or a hand grenade.
Right.
So you make up your own mind on that one.
Yeah.
But we've had a lot of conversation where we've talked about voice, we've talked about parent voice, teacher voice, everybody having a say about things. We've talked a lot about partnerships, both local and global. The people in this room might represent 80% of the world's economy, but they only represent about 15% of the world's population. Do we have a responsibility, given that we're 80% of the world's economy, to be starting to talk about what responsibility we have, especially when we're talking about the future of the teaching profession?
Yep.
Do we have a responsibility to consider, to include, to listen to the other 85% of the world?
Thank you. Okay, any other... I mean, I just think that we just let that sit, and that way, if it was a hand grenade, it doesn't necessarily have to go off. All right. Anybody else just want to enter into the space before we have a conversation around tables? David?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that in my reflection.
Okay.
More, but I think that's absolutely, you know, we've talked about the elephant in the room before. Globally right now, I would say you have teachers who are being prepared at the elementary school level that are then being given classes of about anywhere between 90 and 120 kids.
Yep.
Who are sometimes not paid for a month or two, who when they ask for that payment, were put in jail, could be disappeared. There's about 10 countries right now where teachers absolutely have no right to speak at all. So I think it is important to nest this
okay.
in a much larger thing. But just I can talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
My final reflection.
Great. All right. So, colleagues, can I ask you to take time between now and 3:30, and then we're going to do some really just quick-fire feedback. And look, if you are looking at people at your table and you think these are not the people I want to have the conversation with, thank you. We'll be back in 20. Okay.